is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
If you have been listening to the program, you know we've been thrumming the theme drum over the last few weeks that the economy is weakening, that corporate profits have peaked, and that we may be staring down the throat of another recession. And despite all of this, the Fed is still talking about raising interest rates. Scratch, 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 as to why that might be happening. If we look at the whole recovery since the crash 2007-2008, the recovery has been in fits and starts. Sometimes it spurts up and then flattens off, or sometimes even goes back into negative territory. So it's anything but a normal recovery. However, the one thing you have to come to grips with is that this new abnormal situation is the new normal, and that includes what the central banks are doing, quantitative easing, negative interest rates, and proposed helicopter drops.
You know, it's an interesting concept. And of course, we're in an election year, so you're going to have both parties pointing to the other party's economic policies or what they intend to do. They're going to make it better for all Americans. But really, what's behind all of this, John, is the end of an era. And that's a really important concept to grasp. And the folks that expressed it best were a bank credit analyst. They did a piece called The Debt Supercycle. And let me just kind of review for our listeners, because we've talked about this over the past, but it'll give you an idea of what we're dealing with now and why we're not seeing a monetary policy be as effective, why the traditional patterns of raising interest rates and lowering interest rates aren't generating the same kind of responses that they did for, let's say, 50 or 60 years. And the concept of the debt supercycle is really talking about the long-term decline in U.S. balance sheet liquidity and the concomitant rise in indebtedness following the World War II period. I mean, just take a look at any kind of chart of debt in the United States, whether it's government debt, corporate debt, individual debt, or debt in total, and you can see this upward rising curve, which really accelerated tremendously in the last decade when basically the debt of this country doubled from $28 trillion to over $54 trillion. And we've also seen this, John, with government debt with both presidents. When George W. Bush took over the presidency in 2001, the total government debt was $5 trillion. By the time Bush left his office 8 years later, the national debt was $10 trillion. Barack Obama takes office, and the national debt is $10 trillion. By the time Barack Obama leaves office in January of next year, the national debt will be $20 trillion. In fact, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal this week talking about U.S. debt this year. The deficit will go up to almost $600 billion. It'll be up 22% over last year as the November budget deal busted all the spending caps. So once again, U.S. debt is on the rise. Now, economic expansions since World War II have always been associated with the buildup of debt. Now, prior to World War II, any time you had a buildup of debt, you would have a depression. We had a depression in the 30s. We had a depression in the 20s. We had a depression at the beginning of the 20th century. But that was all prior to the introduction of Keynesian economics. They began with Herbert Hoover and continued with American presidents ever since. And what had happened is every time the economy would go through a downturn, government policy introduced what they call automatic stabilizers. Basically, the welfare state, deposit insurance, unemployment insurance, all those things came into play to reduce the hardship of an economic downturn. So the pain of a Great Depression was avoided, and it was avoided because it was led by government intervention in the economy to smooth out the business cycle. And it was not just the federal government, it was also the Federal Reserve. So what happened is physical and monetary reflation occurred in every economic downturn. We get into a recession. What would happen? The government would stimulate the economy by spending more money, going into debt, creating a deficit, and the Fed would lower interest rates. And so this sort of was the economic pattern that existed until about 2008. So from, you know, 1940 all the way to the, or let's say the 1930s, all the way to the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, that was what happened. The problem was, in every single economic downturn, the buildup of debt and illiquidity would never work itself off. In other words, all the excesses that, for example, occurred during the tech bubble never really worked themselves off. What would happen when the tech bubble burst? Greenspan cut interest rates to the lowest rates that we had seen in almost 100 years. He cut them down to 1%. The Fed flooded the markets with money. Greenspan kept interest rates low. The economy recovered. It expanded. But what it led to was a housing bubble. And then, of course, the housing bubble burst along with the stock market in 2008. And so what we have now, and the reason that the bank credit analysts are calling it the debt supercycle or the end of it, is what the government has been unable to do with low interest rates at the lowest levels of recorded human history is to re-stimulate the financial economy, or let's say the general economy, and get people to go out and start borrowing money excessively like they did in the last decade. So the problem is the authorities have had a lot more problems this time around because, let's put it this way, if you're up in debt to your eyeballs as a consumer, you don't have the ability to go out and borrow. And especially following the financial crisis when your main asset, such as your home, went down in value to the tune of almost 45%. We're doing an interview on lifetime income on Monday with Rick Sharga, who follows the real estate market closely, and we're still not back to levels prior to the Great Recession. So the supercycle process has driven this debt buildup over time, and the authorities have reached the limit of their ability to get consumers to take on more leverage. And so what they're saying right now is the debt supercycle has now entered its final stages with the buildup of government debt.
You know, and the problem is the government spending has its own limitations. And we saw this with President Obama's fiscal stimulus, which really didn't do much of anything. And there was an article I read recently that said, well, we could do several things to jumpstart things. One would be to radically cut back taxes. You'd see that. But of course, they didn't think that much was going to happen. So the central bank is left as the only game in town that what everyone looks toward to say, do something.
And that's the problem. It's really the, I guess, the fiscal policy is in disarray because fiscal policy can help, but it depends on how it's directed. Unfortunately, most of the stimulus, fiscal stimulus, that came in from Obama's stimulus was more in transfer payments. And the problem with transfer payments is if you give somebody an unemployment check or you give somebody a food stamp, the problem is you have to keep giving it. You have to keep giving unemployment checks or keep sending food stamps to keep the economy going. And, you know, we run into a limitation of doing that, even though the number of recipients of food stamps have actually doubled. The way you get off that is to actually get somebody into the job market. So they're actually going out, they're producing something, they're earning money, and as a result of earning money, that's bringing in revenues to the government in the form of taxes, but also it's less government outlays because the government is no longer having to pay for, let's say, unemployment insurance. So the thing that you really want to do is when you do have fiscal policy, you want to get a greater bang for the buck. And we all remember that we were supposed to have all these shovel-ready projects because the Society of Engineers give America's infrastructure a D-. And so we know bridges, dams, all those things are falling apart. That's not where we're spending money. We're spending more money on transfer payments, which are temporary relief in terms of the economy. And that's what we're seeing with the busting of the fiscal budget that was passed last November. Government spending and the government deficit this year will be up by 22% or several hundred billion dollars, John, but it's not going towards bridges, dams, infrastructure, new power structure systems, the building of the highway like what Eisenhower did after World War II. These were things that enhanced the economy's ability to grow. We're not doing that today. And so fiscal policy isn't working, and that's leaving monetary policy. But monetary policy, John, is getting less bang for the buck. And there's a lot of people that are actually questioning monetary policy in terms of its effectiveness in terms of bringing about economic growth.
Let's create a theoretical here. What would happen if we didn't have economic policy as the only game in town? Where would that leave us?
Well, I mean, if we were dealing with higher interest rates with the degree of debt, both at the federal level and at the personal level, John, we would probably be in a Great Depression. So some would argue that, you know, thank goodness we've had monetary policy, because otherwise we have not seen the recovery that we did, even though it's anemic as it has been. But I think there are other factors that are coming into play here that are also mixing in the economic mix. And one is demographics. The population of the world is aging. It's aging here in the country, in the U.S., although because of our immigration policies, which are an issue in this campaign, the U.S. has better demographics than any place else in the world. We're seeing aging demographics in Europe. We're seeing aging demographics now in China and in Japan. And that is having a serious impact in terms of economic growth, because what happens is people age, they quit work, they're drawing down on the system. That means entitlement spending is going up for all governments, whether it's Europe, the U.S., or Japan. So instead of working, they're actually drawing down on assets, living off those assets, and they spend less money. The other thing that we're seeing is the rapid formation of technological disruptions. I mean, take a look at social media, how that's changed. Take a look at the kind of devices that we have today that we take for granted, from our smartphones, which are computers. Take a look at how online retailing has changed the retail space and the impact that that has had. You know, probably in the next 10 years, probably a third of all shopping centers that you're going to see are going to go by the wayside, because a lot more people will be shopping online. So we'll have less need for shopping centers. And then the other thing that we're seeing is the second largest economy in the world, China, is going through a growth slowdown. And of course, we can all recall last decade when China was growing by double-digit interest rates each year, which was driving the demand for commodities, for imports, exports, all these kind of things. So we're seeing the world's second largest economy and the most populous nation on earth going through a growth slowdown. So that's also having an impact. So the result, John, is I don't care where you are looking today. The IMF this week talked about a global slowdown. Once again, they revised their economic growth projections for this year. The OECD just released their leading economic indicators pointing to a growth slowdown. And then on this Friday, the G20 are meeting, and they're talking and they're warning on the very issue you and I are talking about here today, of government's reliance on monetary policy. And they're basically saying, look, guys, you need to kickstart the economy. Economic stimulus cannot do it by itself. You have to start spending money, and spending money to stimulate the economy. So, you know, once again, on top of the debt super cycle overthrow on that, several larger macro forces like demographics, tech disruptions, and also the slowdown of the world's largest economy, John. And that's why you and I have been talking about over the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen the economy grow from fits and starts. Normally, it used to be very strong in the second and third quarter of the year, which we can see that similar pattern developing. Second quarter economic growth might be slightly better than first quarter economic growth, John, but we're going to have a very, very hard time this year of hitting 2% growth rates on the economy here in the U.S. because, as we've been talking here in the program, corporate profits have peaked. Along with corporate profits, economic growth has peaked. So we're now in the final phase of this economic recovery, and we're going through a growth slowdown.
Well, coming up right shortly, not on the program, but in the world, corporate earnings season is virtually upon us, and we're going to get the first quarter GDP numbers. Now, looking at the indicators that you follow, what are they telling you about all of this?
I mean, all of this points to a slowdown. I mean, we had retail sales figures come out this week, and they're down for the third month in a row. So that's a weakening trend as well. And that's very important because 70% of the U.S. economy is based on consumption. We know business investment, residential and commercial has been weak. And, you know, companies aren't going to build factories. They're not going to be spending money on building new plant or spending money on equipment when they're seeing a weakening in global growth. And that's happening for many of the U.S. companies that make up the S&P 500 or the Dow. They're international companies. And the trend has been for lower economic growth. And as that happens, obviously sales start to slow down, profits start to peak, companies start cutting back. We're seeing that in the labor figures that we've been watching with the decline in temporary employment and the work week. And we're also seeing that, John, I suspect that, you know, the figures that we're looking at right now when it comes to Q1 earnings is I think you're going to see earnings season will be a lot worse than is anticipated. Now, a lot of the analysts have already downgraded a lot of, you know, it's the earnings game. What happens about a month before the quarter ends? Analysts come out, they downgrade their earnings projections for companies, and then companies come out and they beat them. But if we take a look at, you know, earnings are following a trend that has been in a pattern since the summer of 2014. And that is they peaked. And what we're seeing now, a lot of the bulls have argued, well, gosh, the reason that we're seeing earnings drop, a lot of that reflects the energy industry, which is about 20%. And of course, we know what has happened to the price of oil. It's fallen 70%. So naturally, you would see earnings coming from energy companies, whether energy service or producers or integrated oil companies to decline. But now what we're starting to see is the spread of earnings declines go across a wide swath of industries. We talked about, there was a recent study done about the 10 sectors within the S&P, and two-thirds of those companies in those sectors have had difficulty raising prices. So, you know, that tells me that we're going to see this continuation of a trend of an earnings slowdown that by summer we could start seeing, as we saw last month, that we saw an uptick in the unemployment rate to 5%. A lot of people are saying that's because, you know, a lot more people are coming back into the workforce. So the participation rate is going up. But I fully suspect, John, as we head in closer towards the end of the year, you're going to start to see the gradual rise in unemployment claims, and you're going to start to see a gradual rise in the unemployment rate. So we're seeing this trend continue, and we see it almost every quarter. The Fed downgrades its economic forecast. The IMF is downgrading its economic forecast. The OECD is downgrading. And then on this Friday with the meeting of the G20, they're basically saying, hey, we see the limits of central bank intervention. Governments step up to the plate and start spending money if we don't want to see another economic downturn.
Do you suppose this could be some of the motivation as to why it seems both Dems and Republicans busted the budget deal last November because they saw this as well?
Well, sure, absolutely. No political party, Democrat or Republican or whoever holds the White House, wants to, let's say, head into a presidential election year with the economy in recession and the unemployment rate rising. Barack Obama knows that that's how he got elected. In 2008, we were in a financial crisis and a very, very steep, deep recession. And it's interesting because one of the stories this week was Obama called Janet Yellen to the White House. And I'm sure the message had to be, I'd love to have been a fly on the wall, is, hey, Janet, why don't you hold off on raising interest rates? The last thing we want is a falling stock market and a downturn in the economy as we head into the fall elections. And that's why even right now, John, there's a disparity between the Fed dot plot, which says the Fed will raise interest rates twice this year. Now, the current consensus is they don't expect anything to happen this month or next week's meeting. So the consensus right now is one time in June, and maybe they go on pause for about 4 or 5 months until after the election, and they raise it in December. But the futures market isn't buying, and the futures market is saying, you know, they may not go at all this year, especially when you keep seeing the IMF lowering their economic projections, the OECD lowering their economic projections, and then on this Friday, the G20 coming together and say monetary policy isn't cutting it. We need to step up fiscal spending if we're going to avoid a downturn. So I very much suspect that the budget deal that was put together in November. And plus, I don't think neither side had the stomach to have a knockdown, drag out fight with the government shut down, with, you know, the Republicans trying to or hoping to recapture the White House after being out of office for almost 8 years. So I think that has a lot to do with it.
Well, you have to sort of look at the game that the Fed is doing right now. What they're trying to do is they're making attempts to normalize monetary policy, and they're doing this by raising interest rates to give themselves some wiggle room. So they're trying to raise the interest rates without damaging whatever exists of the recovery in the economy right now. But the real question is, how far are they really going to get with it? I mean, this is really fine tuning now, Jim. And what happens if they don't get enough room in there when we run smack into the next recession where they're going to have to do something?
Well, I think that's the dilemma that the Fed is dealing with right now. And you look at some of this dovish talk, and I would expect that dovish talk to continue if we see these continuation of trends of weakening economies both here and abroad. The problem that we have is some are calling the impotence of monetary policy, which was, if you read through the fine print of the G20 statement on Friday, they were saying, hey, look, we see the limitations of monetary policy. And the problem is monetary policy, the way that monetary policy works is to boost credit supply and demand. In other words, by keeping interest rates artificially low, central banks hope to get you, the consumer, or a business to go out there, borrow money, expand, build a new plant and equipment, go out, buy a new house, go out and spend money. The problem is it hasn't worked, and that gets back to the debt supercycle, which we started out this conversation, is debt levels are way too high. And it doesn't matter what interest rates are today. If you cannot or don't have the ability to borrow, doesn't matter what the rate is. You just hope that you were fortunate enough that your house went back up in value, that you were able to, let's say, refinance your house and bring down your payments. So since the credit mechanism is not working, then the other way that monetary policy works as a transmission channel is through asset prices, meaning asset prices rise, and exchange rates, meaning lower exchange rates. And what is happening is with lower interest rates, the central banks are hoping that as asset prices rise, people feel wealthier, they feel better about spending, and they're more apt to open up their checkbook and spend a few bucks. So asset prices, and certainly, if anything, that's probably been the most effective means of what the Fed has been able to accomplish. I mean, the stock market is up 230% from, let's say, 2009. The other means of stimulating economic growth is through the debasement of currency. In other words, lowering the currency. And we're seeing that in Europe. We're seeing it in Japan. And of course, we saw it with the Fed with QE, when the value of the dollar fell from 2009 to almost 2011. The problem is that has a limitation too, because you can only increase asset prices so much before you get into an asset bubble, which is what we saw with technology in the 90s in real estate in the last decade. So there's a real risk that you increase asset prices to such a level, eventually they burst and you have a bubble, and we have the same problem that we had in 2008 and 2009. The other issue that central banks have is trying to debase their currency, because you run into the classic fallacy of composition. One country may get away from, let's say, pushing their exchange rate down against other countries as long as other countries don't respond. But the problem is, if everybody starts to do the same thing and they all engage in competitive devaluations, then it becomes a self-defeating game, because you devalue, well, if you're going to do it, I'm going to devalue. So this is why, John, they're running into limitations of what they're able to do, the effectiveness in terms of, or let's say the efficacy of monetary policy, which was really the sort of summary of the G20 meeting on Friday, is saying, you know what, governments, we got to step up to the plate, and we got to start spending money. In other words, fiscal policy has got to be implemented, because monetary policy by itself is not going to be able to do this. And monetary policy is most effective when combined with fiscal policy, as it was in 2009, when the government spent a $1 trillion fiscal stimulus and the Fed printed $1 trillion.
All right, Jim, if we look at this outcome, then we have to ask, what is the likely strategy the Fed is going to have to pursue or is pursuing here, especially if they can't raise the interest rates as much as they want. You can't tell me they're not thinking about this.
Well, I mean, there's a number of things they can do. In fact, there was a conference last fall with former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, and they were bringing up this next issue and saying, look, you need to raise interest rates. But if you cannot get interest rates where you want them to go, what are you going to do? And a lot of people are saying that they've run out of bullets. And Bernanke, in his speech, he made four key points. He said, no. He goes, we still have many things that we can do. Number one, we can go to negative interest rates. And hence, remember back in February, John, let's go to that clip where I think it was a congressman that was asking Janet Yellen about negative interest rates.
And I guess the question then is, so you've got a pretty loaded up balance sheet, and I think people are beginning to observe that the Fed is probably out of ammunition unless you decided to go to negative rates. And if you could briefly, I'm not proposing this. I'm just observing what's happening around the world and what's happening here in our own country. I think people are waking up and realizing that the Fed really has no real ammunition left. You alluded to this some yesterday, but and I have one more question, so I don't want this to be too long, but are you considering, if things go south, which none of us hope do, are you considering negative rates? I know you had that question yesterday. Yes or no?
So the answer is that we had previously considered them and decided that they would not work well to foster accommodation back in 2010. In light of the experience of European countries and others that have gone to negative rates, we're taking a look at them again because we would want to be prepared in the event that we needed to add accommodation. We haven't finished that evaluation. We need to consider the U.S. institutional context and whether they would work well here. It's not automatic.
Yeah.
There are a number of things to consider. We haven't. I wouldn't take those off the table, but we would have work to do to judge whether they would be workable here.
Janet Yellen during congressional testimony, and it's obvious they're thinking about it because they already see banks elsewhere in the world doing this.
Yeah, in Bernanke's speech last fall, he said, look, we still have four things that we can do, and I would argue five. He goes, negative interest rates. Europe has showed that modestly negative interest rates are possible. It has had an effect of a stimulus in Europe. Not so much in Japan, because it's backfiring in Japan where people are taking their money out of the bank. They're buying safes and keeping their cash there. But I think that is more of a reflection of 25 years of low interest rates in Japan, where you've had quantitative easing after quantitative easing for almost going on 3 decades now. So number one, Bernanke was talking a week ago to negative interest rates. Number two is they could peg the short-dated treasury, in other words, two-year treasury yields, and use a combination to achieve that either through communication to the market and some kind of forward guidance, or actually intervening in the treasury market, driving down treasury yields. Number three, and I suspect we are more likely to see this, this will be the first thing they do in the next downturn, is further quantitative easing. And then number four, Bernanke talked about change the target. In other words, instead of inflation targeting of 2%, they could raise that, or they could move to nominal GDP targeting, saying that, you know, until we see nominal GDP growth of 3 or 4%, we're going to keep this loosey-goosey thing. And I would argue, John, what you're going to probably see in the next downturn. And remember, we started out with QE1. That was only supposed to last a year, and it was going to get better. Well, that didn't work. We started QE2, and then that was only supposed to last for a limited period of time. We know that didn't work, and we came up with QE3 and QE4. I think what you're going to see in this next downturn is they initially will bring down interest rates to negative territory or down to zero again, and then they'll announce, you know, who knows, a $1 trillion to $2 trillion quantitative easing program. But I think the next thing that you will see, it'll be combined with fiscal policy, and we'll get into what we call helicopter money. It goes back to, once again, a Bernanke speech back in 2002 saying that a central bank can always generate inflation if it prints enough money. And if things do not go well in the next downturn, and obviously the traditional monetary tools that worked for a half a century aren't working anymore, watch for some kind of fiscal policy. And you saw that on Friday with the G20 already hinting that's the direction we're going in. In other words, governments need to ramp up their budget deficits by fiscal spending, and then central banks can come in and mop it up. So, John, I think the next thing that you're going to see following quantitative easing will be helicopter drops. It could be a tax stimulus. Remember that in 2010 where they reduced payroll taxes for a year, and then there were targeted tax cuts, and you could see that where there's some kind of compromise reached between both parties, but I think you're going to see targeted tax cuts. Tax cuts will be the thing that they're going to do, because, folks, forget Bernie Sanders raising taxes or Hillary Clinton. You raise taxes in this anemic economy, and you have interest rates rising at the same time with Fed rate hikes. You're going to put this economy back into a severe recession, and no politician wants to see that. So forget a lot of the rhetoric that's being thrown out there in an election year, because a lot of those promises are never kept.
So if we take a snapshot where we are now and where we anticipate we will go, you can look around, you can see that the economy is weakening, not just here, but globally. And we see that in indications from the IMF, the OECD, the G20 countries, and even the Fed's own downward revisions in its predictions. And so what that means, running out of room, so to speak, in the next downturns, we're probably going to see more quantitative easing. They'll do this to try to get it started back up again, along with helicopter drops, as they are affectionately called, helicopter drops of money, as was used in, first of all, 2001 with the Bush tax cuts, and then payroll reductions, if you remember, back in 2010. That seems to be one of the few set of weapons left in their arsenal.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
This is Chris Sheridan, and I'm host of the weekday broadcast called FS Insider. Next week, we're going to be speaking to Jeff Christian at the CPM Group. In our last interview with him in December of 2015, he talked about how they expected to see a moderate increase in the price of gold this year and a possible boomerang effect as record unprecedented short positions in gold flip to the long side. And we certainly saw that earlier this year. So he's going to give us an update on his views and his long-term outlook. Here's a preview of that interview airing next week.
We issued a long-term buy recommendation in November of 2000, and then we issued a sell recommendation in January of 2012. And when we said that, we said, look, we think that we are at a near-term cyclical peak and that the gold price and other commodity prices could fall for the next 3 to 5 years in what we called a cyclical downward move within the context of a longer-term secular bull market. In other words, from a long-term perspective, commodities, and especially gold and silver, are in a long-term upward shift. And that shift, which has been reflected in higher prices, is really in demand. And there's been an upward shift in fabrication demand for gold and silver, but the real shift has been on the investment market. And since 2000, you've seen more investors buying more gold at higher prices, more types of investors in different parts of the world for a longer period of time than ever before in history. And what that means is the investment demand curve has shifted upward. And you have a lot of investors who, having lived through the 80s and 90s, and then the financial problems of 2000, 2001, and everything that came along in the ensuing 12 years, you've got a lot of investors who are saying, I don't care how beautiful the world looks and how attractive the stock market is and how lucrative the U.S. real estate market might be, I want to have more of my wealth stored in gold and silver than before.
So you don't want to miss that broadcast with Jeff Christian airing next. If you'd like to become a subscriber to our weekday FS Insider premium broadcast, which we do 3 days a week, you can do so by going to financialsense.com and clicking where it says subscribe now on the homepage.
Here we are in April right now, and very shortly we're going to be hitting summer, mid-year. If this has been a weird year because it seems to be going by incredibly rapidly, and we'll be talking about outcomes for the second half of 2016 and what we think they are most likely to be.
Yeah, it's rather interesting, and even though we've been talking here on the program, John, about the economy having peaked, and we're on the final down cycle of this economic expansion, in a high probability that sometime next year we will be in another recession. So it's rather interesting because this is a presidential election year. We talked about in the last segment how Congress, basically with the president, they busted the budget caps in the budget deal that they put together last November. And so the government budget deficit this year is going to be closer to $600 billion. It's going to be up about 22% over last year. So the government's pushing a lot of money through the economy. The problem is we got, 1.4% economic growth in Q4 of last year. And the stuff that we're looking at right now, John, for the remainder of this year, or at least in Q1, we're looking at economic growth rate of roughly about 1%. I mean, if you take a look at the LEIs from, you know, the ISM non-manufacturing index, the ISM manufacturing industrial production down again last month, retail sales reported this week falling for 3 months in a row. So there are a number of factors that tell us that Q1, I mean, we're basically cruising along at around a 1% pace. It might pick up a little bit with some stimulus spending here in the second quarter, and especially the pullback in the dollar. But, you know, as we look at this economy going forward for the second half of the year, we see economic weakness and we see that trend continuing, and it's not going to get any better, and it's not going to be helped if the Fed does proceed. For whatever reason, they think it's strong enough to push through another rate hike. It's not going to help. The good news is the global economy is still growing, even though we've seen the IMF, the OECD, the G20 all downgrade economic growth rates around the world. The economies are still growing because the ECB's printing money, negative interest rates, Japan's printing money, China is stimulating its economy. And despite all this talk about the Fed raising interest rates, you know, Fed funds rate at 0.5% is still very accommodative when it comes to interest rates. It's keeping mortgage rates down. And the fact that the Fed is tightened, money is flowing into the U.S., suppressing the yield curve, meaning the long end of the Treasury curve is below 2%. And there are some saying in the next downturn, we may get down to a 1% yield on 10-year Treasuries. So, John, I mean, right now, interest rates are still low. So that is still good news. But, you know, once again, I guess the best way to look at this, economic growth is still growing. We're not in a recession. But clearly, with fiscal policy in disarray, which was, once again, we talked about the G20 on Friday with a clarion call to all countries to start stimulating their economy from a fiscal basis. So one of the predictions that we see is we will avoid a recession this year. The U.S. economy will limp along barely. I just don't see the Fed's forecast of 2.4% this year. That would imply a 3% GDP growth for Q2, 3, and 4. And I just don't see that happening. Where are we starting to see a peak in economic activity? And it's just nuanced right now, but little by little, I don't care if it's retail sales, the buildup of business inventories, or a tick up in the unemployment rate, a drop in temp employment in the hour work week. Little by little, we're seeing more and more pieces of evidence that this downturn in the economy is continuing. And I suspect it'll probably get a little bit more turbulent as we head into the summer. So one prediction that we see going forward, John, is that the economy, the good news here, it'll avoid a recession. And the good thing about that, when we talk about stocks or asset classes, it's much easier for the markets to absorb shockwaves, be it it's a terrorist attack, whatever it is, when the economy is growing than when it is in stall speed or in a recession. So the good news here is the economy continues to grow, and it should continue to grow for the remainder of the year. In other words, the risk of recession is rising. It's getting larger, and I suspect it to increase each quarter going forward. But I guess if you want to draw good news out of here, all of this is the economy continues to limp along, just barely, but we will still be growing.
Well, we still have the Fed here talking about raising interest rates, but then there are some interactions as a result of that, given that the other banks right now, like the Bank of Japan right now, which I think is in far worse shape than we are in terms of their ability to handle this type of thing. You can hear them winding up the helicopter rotors right now, getting ready for takeoff. If we do some raising here, how it's going to affect what's going on over there?
You know what? I continue to see that. I mean, in other words, it's one of the limitations that we're seeing in Fed policy, because the more the Fed talks hawkish, or the more the Fed talks about raising interest rates, what does that mean? Short-term rates are rising here, and it's attractive. I mean, if you take a look at a two-year Treasury note, a little over 70 basis points or 0.7%, you compare that to a 10-year German bond yield that is 0.1%. That is just going to make the dollar stronger, drive more money into this country. A stronger dollar hurts manufacturing, hurts exports, hurts the economy, and makes it even weaker. So I would suspect that that trend is going to continue, in the sense that the Bank of Japan is thinking about even going more negative on interest rates, along with the ECB. The ECB is already now talking about buying other assets than, let's say, sovereign debt. They're talking about buying corporate debt. And so I would say, John, get ready for helicopter drops. I think they will begin overseas first. And then if the U.S. economy goes into a downturn, the next president of the United States with a new Congress and a Federal Reserve, we could see helicopter drops here. In other words, just as the G20 is saying, hey, guys, start ramping up spending. And I think that's going to be the next thing that you're going to see, is a likely stimulus to try to keep economies out of recession and keep them floating, is going to be helicopter drops. And so all of that bodes well, by the way, for real assets, especially the gold market, which is maybe what gold has been sniffing all along.
You remember that George Bush did that. He did tax cuts, and the Fed was able to keep interest rates low, and we actually popped out of it as a result of that, although politically the opposition was in there howling and screaming, and when President Obama's administration came along, didn't believe in tax cuts, actually keeps talking about more and more taxes, as you're hearing both from Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders right now.
Yeah, that's one of the things I think is going to change. I think there will be a broad consensus, because one of the things that we have seen as a result of the first stimulus, which did not work well, was gridlock between both political parties. There just hasn't been the stomach. In fact, we had the sequester of anything, cutting back on government spending and trying to rein in the budget deficit. Because remember, in 2009 and 10, the budget deficit of the United States was $1.4 trillion. That's a lot of money. And that's one reason we're talking about a $20 trillion government debt by the time Obama leaves office. But I think, John, you're going to start to see it. The G20 are already prepping. That's what they're recommending, because they're seeing the limitation of monetary policy. And so I think that's what's going to happen. You're going to see governments start to cut taxes and increase spending. And then you're just simply going to see monetary policy come in, mop it up, and print the money to pay for it. So I basically see helicopter drops flooding the economy with money and pushing up inflation in the process, because everything else has not worked. Monetary policy by itself, about the only thing it's been effective to do, I mean, it's kept us out of a recession, but it's been more effective in inflating assets and debasing currencies than it has in terms of stimulating economic growth, because economic growth has been subpar and anemic, and that's been an issue of a number of factors. Number one, too much debt that was built up in the last decade and the end of the debt supercycle, as the folks at Bank Credit Analysts talk about. But it's also some other trends that are factoring in here. Aging demographics, technological change is also another major issue that has come into play here.
You know, the Fed's trying to give the impression, I guess maybe it's what they're doing, they've pulled back lately on pushing this whole interest rates thing, but they're really not backing off overall. They haven't said, nah, that was a bad idea. We're not going to do that.
They're really trying to, in hope that they can get themselves to a normalization. That's what they're trying to do. And unfortunately, John, you know, we have a saying here, they'll keep doing something until something breaks. And right now, nothing has broken yet. I mean, the economy is still growing. The stock market, after going down for 2 months at the beginning of the year, is now in positive territory. So that's going. So they're still holding that. They're basically saying, well, we got to go slow. We're going to be a lot more cautious. But they're still talking about raising rates, and they will do what they always do. They will continue to do something until something breaks. So I suspect they've got to be a little bit cautious here on the June rate hike, because the timing of the June FOMC meeting is right around the time Britain votes whether they're going to exit the euro. And you do not want to be hiking interest rates if Britain does indeed pull out of the euro, because you're going to have all kinds of chaos in the European currency. And what that would mean is the euro would probably depreciate. You would have a crisis in the financial markets in Europe. And then all of that means is money would flow into the dollar, driving down interest rates and driving the dollar up higher. So right now they're talking dovish, but they haven't changed their tune yet. They still want to raise interest rates and hope that they can. And I think it's also credibility with the Fed. I mean, what does it say if the Fed took 2 years to raise interest rates a quarter of a point, and that was all they were able to do? You would kind of question whether the central bank would be effective. And it's a confidence game. And I think if that's all they were able to do is raise interest rates a quarter of a point, I think you would have a confidence game and a real issue of confidence with the Fed. So I think that they are still going to, you know, maybe letting this market settle down, seeing how economic growth, watching how other stimulus from the ECB and Japan kicks in. I think that they're going to maybe hold off, be a little bit more cautious, but I still think they're going to proceed and try to move forward.
Well, I'm assuming then that just as you and Mark Chandler were discussing in hour one, this downtrend in the dollar is temporary, and you're assuming that the dollar is going to go higher.
I really do, because one of the sayings that we have here is the U.S. has the best looking house in a global neighborhood, and we still do. Economic growth, as anemic as it is here, is better than it is over there. And remember, it's only our central bank that's talking about raising rates. No other central bank, the ECB, Japan, the Bank of China, they're not talking. So you look at the other three large economies in the globe, they're talking about, you know, helicopter drops, negative interest rates. So if Britain was to exit, if you had more problems in Europe, if you had more problems in Japan, their economy remains mired in a recession, that's only going to make the dollar stronger as a safe haven. So dollars could come in here. And that's why my good friend Gary Schilling thinks that when this is all said and done, we're going to see a 10-year treasury note yield at somewhere around 1% and 30-year treasury bonds below 2%. So that could very well happen. So I still expect, you know, that one of the safe havens, if these things begin to unfold, the economy weakens, corporate profits have peaked, we see lower corporate earnings. I think what you're going to see, John, is a stronger dollar and lower treasury yields is a possibility.
Now, what about the stock market in the middle of all of this?
You know what I think? I think 2016 is going to look very similar to 2015, where we were back and forth. We had periods where we went through a strong market upsurge followed by a market downturn. I mean, just take a look at the beginning of the year when we went down for about 6 weeks, and now we've had this strong rally and we're sort of going sideways. And I think it was one of the technicians that we had on the program, Dan Wotropski, that talked about what we're going through is a time correction in the market. So if you take a look at where the stock market has been, where it sort of peaked in the fall of 2014, we've been sort of going sideways, this back and forth, going through 10-12% drops as we did in August of last year, September of last year, and then this swoon upwards as we saw towards the last part of the year last year, and then this downturn we saw at the beginning of the year, and now we're going through this upsurge. And I think it's pretty much going to be that way because we still have economic growth. We still have very accommodative central bank policy. I just think what we're seeing here is a range-bound market or what Dan Wojtowski calls a sideways or a time correction. In other words, the correction is taking place over time rather than this swoon downwards, as we saw in these corrections in August, September, and what we saw at the beginning of this year.
Well, as we plow into the beginning of the rest of the year here shortly, anything else that you're seeing?
You know, I think that in the area of commodities, we've had this kind of risk-on rally that we've seen take place in February, especially in the gold market, which has been very strong. And then, of course, oil prices bottoming at around $26 a barrel all the way up over to $40. The two exceptions that I see in the commodity space is both gold, which is operating in an ideal environment with negative interest rates, and especially if we start getting to helicopter drops. And then also a lot of things that we're seeing in the price of oil is this correction. Of course, we got Doha this weekend. I don't expect to see much out of that, but even OPEC, within OPEC and even Russia, a lot of these countries are hurting right now. They're going through their foreign currency reserves. They need these higher prices. Even Saudi Arabia needs $30 oil to pay its budget bills. And so we're seeing production fall far sharper. In fact, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal this week that OPEC is seeing far sharper expected drops in production. A lot of that is coming mainly in Western countries, especially in shale plays around the United States. So that is some of the biggest things that we've seen, is that this rally in oil, you know, we did a show, I think what was in February, we thought we had seen a bottom in the oil market, and we're seeing, you know, some very astute traders. There's a hedge fund that has been playing the short end of the oil market. They've been doing that for the last 2 years. They have just swung around, and they're going in the opposite direction, going long oil. So basically, I think these cutbacks that we're seeing here in the U.S., mainly, especially with the international oil companies, are starting to kick in. So I think the one exception to this is going to be in the commodity space is going to be energy, which is going to kick in as a lot of these cutbacks in CapEx spending, drilling for new places. And also, don't forget, the other thing that the oil market has going that we forget about is depletion. Meaning those older wells are depleting. They're producing less and less oil. And if countries or companies are not drilling more aggressively for new oil to replace that, it's not just the fact that you have the drop in the rig count. It's also the fact that you have a drop in depletion rates that are really starting to hit and impact the market. So I would say in the commodity space, we see weaker commodity prices going forward until we start getting into what I call helicopter drops, in which in that case you see large currency debasement and you start seeing a swing in a movement towards real assets, especially when you start seeing currency devaluations take place. So I see further weakness in the oil markets going forward. And John, I would expect that trend to continue.
I know a lot of the technicians have been talking about a rally in risk assets, but what do you do if you're looking for yield in this kind of an environment?
You know, you're going to have to stay with defensive type stocks. I mean, we're still living in an environment where the yield on high dividend paying stocks, quality stocks, is offering a higher yield than what you can get, let's say, in a 10-year treasury around 1.7 and 1.8%. So you're going to have to go there. We're playing the short-term corporate bond market where the yields are 4 and 5%. I think you have to be in that space. But also, I would be real leery right now. If you're in junk bonds, if you're in a junk bond fund, you might want to talk about taking some profits, because as this economy begins to weaken, you're going to see default rates in junk bonds start to accelerate. I've read some recent reports that you could see as much as a 20% default rate in junk bonds. And I'm not just speaking about the energy sector, where we're starting to see a lot more of these defaults take place, but it's spreading beyond the energy sector, even in the area of technology. So I would take some profits in the junk bond market, because as the economy begins to weaken and as we head into a recession, look for more defaults in the junk bond space. And then as you start to see that accelerate as the economy weakens, then you can see big, big spreads widen tremendously in the corporate bond market, which is going to hurt your returns, meaning that if you're in a junk bond fund or a high-yield bond fund, you're going to end up losing a lot of money, as happened in, let's say, 2013 and happened last year. in the fourth quarter of last year, we saw credit spreads just really blow out on corporate bonds, between corporate bonds and sovereigns. And John, that could happen as we head further into the year, as the economy begins to weaken. Because let's face it this way, what happens when the economy weakens? Sales drop, company profit margins get squeezed, companies have a more difficult time refinancing their debt, and as loan defaults start to step up, banks start to tighten credit standards, it's harder for companies to roll over debt. And then also, as credit spreads start to widen and climb in the junk bond market, it makes it even more difficult for companies to refinance their debt. I mean, right now, you got junk bond yields that are over 8%. So, you know, as we head further into recession, we could see junk bond yields get back up over 10%, which means bond investors could be experiencing double-digit losses in the bond market.
Well, here we are staring toward the summer, and we'll see whether or not those predictions happen, such as the economy is going to weaken, the stock market's probably going to go sideways. What about the political election? Because we really are coming down to the intense months, especially after we find out who the two candidates really are from the left and the right, the Democrats and Republicans. How is that going to factor into everything?
As we get closer to, let's say, the conventions, when we know the candidates, who are they going to be? It's probably going to be Donald Trump on the Republican side, Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side. One of the things, John, that you've seen on both sides, whether you're looking at what Trump has done in the Republican Party or Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party, there is a lot of angst out there and anger with the political establishment in both parties. So neither party can take comfort and say, well, you know, people are really upset with the other guys. You know, people are upset with both parties, and that's reflected in the candidates and the popularity. I mean, Hillary Clinton is not packing 20,000 people into a stadium gathering like Bernie Sanders, and none of the Republican candidates, Cruz or Kasich, are putting 20, 30,000 people in the stadium the way Donald Trump's doing. So the outside candidates seem to have sort of captured the voter attention right now, and it's just very difficult to say what these candidates will actually do if they get into office. I think Donald Trump has a better grasp of business than, let's say, a Hillary Clinton. But I also am not a keen favor of Trump's protectionist measures and this concept of China's manipulating its currency, which I disagree with. They wouldn't be pegging their currency to the dollar. I think as we get closer to the election, and as we have platforms coming out of the convention of the Republicans, will say, if you elect us, this is what we intend to do and promise to do, just as Hillary Clinton will have her platform and say, if you elect me, well, we know what she's going to do. At least right now, she's going to raise spending and she's going to raise taxes. So more taxes, more regulation. And I think you'll see the markets start tuning more and more as we get to, let's say, September. Not much, I don't think, until by the time we get to September, the markets are going to start paying a lot more attention to the political process. But this is really going to be a difficult one to call.
Well, I think all of what we're discussing here, though, is going to have some kind of a key outcome, and who winds up in the Oval Office is important, too, because, you know, President Obama got his stimulus package and we saw how far that went. The next president, if, say, he or she is in office for 4 to 8 years, is going to preside over some really turbulent economic terrain, and that's going to be really critical.
Yeah, it really is, because you're going to want to have cooperation between both sides. And we had that when Obama first came into office. He got a stimulus package through, but when people saw the results and what happened to the budget deficit, which just blew through the doors at $1.4 trillion, this time, John, you can't have gridlock. In other words, if the country's in a recession, I don't think either party can sit there and say, well, we're not going to do anything because we don't like what you're proposing. So it's going to take somebody with negotiating skills to bring both parties together, because you're going to have fiscal stimulus, because monetary policy is simply not going to be effective in revitalizing the economy if we head back into another recession.
All right, Jim, that is pretty much the layout of second half of the year, but let's tighten it up a little bit and say, what are we all looking forward to over the next few weeks here on the program?
Well, we're going to be full bore in the earnings season, so it's going to be interesting to take a look at what's going out or what these companies are going to report for Q1 and also what they're going to be saying about Q2, because, you know, the Fed is projecting that, hey, things are actually going to pick up and get a little better as we head further into the year, which we just don't see that. We don't see the, you know, the economy growing at 2.9% a year to hit the Fed's targets. It's just not going to happen. So we got corporate earnings seasons coming out ahead of us. We've got the FOMC meeting next week, although there is not a press conference following this meeting. And that should give us some clues and set the stage up in terms of what we're going to see coming in June. You know, for some reason, this reminds me of last year, John, when remember we were going to have the first rate hike coming in June. And of course, that didn't happen. Then it was September. Well, it didn't happen till December. And I think they're going to have some reluctance here, given on some of the economic numbers that we've seen that have been particularly weak here recently, and it's starting to form a trend. This isn't just like a one-off event. It's 1 month, and then the following month, things are back to, you know, hunky-dory again. That's not happening. There's a trend now. We've had a drop in retail sales for 3 months. We're seeing the economic numbers weaken. We're seeing the number of jobs created start to fall. We've seen the unemployment rate go up. We're starting to see business inventories go up. So for me, I just don't, in the futures market, thinks there's only about 11% probability that they raise rates in June. And it's rather interesting, as we talked earlier in the show, Obama invited Janet Yellen to the White House this week. And, you know, you wonder what they're talking about. I imagine it isn't, hey, Janet, I'm glad to see that you're raising interest rates as we head into the election. It's kind of like, you know, what are you guys seeing? And what does it really look like economic-wise? Because if we're seeing these numbers, you imagine the White House is also seeing these numbers and paying close attention, especially in an election year, because a weak economy is bad news for the party in power. But all that's coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.